Good songs. Thank you, Brother Bry. Looking forward to the message. Just wanted to give a quick word of greeting tonight and remind all of you that if you hear or know of someone in great need, please let us know. Maybe we can make a difference as a church and in the name of the Lord Jesus. Also, if you yourself would like a driveway drive-by, please let us know, and we'll be glad to do that this week, just as a means of encouraging you as well as encouraging us. All right? So Lord bless you. We love you folks very much, and we miss you very much, and we're praying for you. Pastor Brian.
All right. Well, good evening. And as we turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we'll begin there in verse 12. As I just mentioned, as before we sing that last song, as we look to Christ to help us, and as we pray to him to start tonight, again, in his wisdom, the author is going to take us on a quest. He made a conclusion that we looked at the introduction 2 weeks ago, that life gained sought in this life under the sun, creation is not set up for that. And that is the conclusion he needed to bring us to, that when you're looking for gain in this creator or trying to gain advancement, you're going to come to this conclusion of you can't grasp it. Life does feel meaningless. It's just quick and fades away. So that's how he introduced it. And it's almost like the author is going to say, well, let me then show you how I came to that conclusion. Or is that conclusion really valid? That's kind of what he's going to do tonight, is take us on that quest. So the quest is going to be not, again, I think, it's not for the faint of heart. It is for one who's going to have to believe and follow God as he lays it out to this author, and we need his help to do so. So let's ask for help, and we'll begin. God, thank you for your skill and your wisdom to teach us as dear children. And we do rejoice that the way you teach us is, yes, you do have extremely bright hope for us, full confidence that you can be trusted. But then I know as a good father, you do take different ways of teaching us to show us things that don't matter. And so we're going to need your help tonight to follow that, for some of the conclusions can feel, I guess the word could be feeling hopeless, but I pray that you would point our hearts to true gain and finding enjoyment in our God. And we ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. Well, I don't apologize to say many times my illustrations are going to have a lot of camp lingo in them, because that's been a lot of the history of what God's allowed me to be involved in. But I was thinking through one part of camp. Camp program guys are always on the search for games that are unique to camp. Like, it's a good and sometimes a bad thing. And reflecting back on our beginning years at the camp in North Louisiana that I've mentioned before, I remember one such creative endeavor. At the center of our camp lay a 23-acre lake. And honestly, the lake was something very pleasant to the eyes, and watching the sun reflect off of it and on the breeze making the ripples across the lake. It also had the added enjoyment of fishing for perch, bass, and many other fish in that lake. However, as beautiful as that was, it was not always pleasant to swim in. Nevertheless, every week we had water games in the shallow end of that lake. And it was nasty. And when we first got there, we spent many hours just getting seaweed out of it, like to try to make it look pleasant. In one of our first years at the camp, the program guys took a watermelon and they greased it up. They then put the water in and commenced what I call a rugby-type game, in which the two teens of teenage guys were wrestling with the watermelon in order to get it in their desired goal. I still have images of those guys just trying to go after that watermelon. They're going after it, and it's squeezing, and it's popping out. The quest was unique, but it left us guessing as to why the game was ever used in camp. And as far as I know, that game was never used again. Now, if I were to evaluate the game for its effectiveness, I may come to the conclusion like, that was one frustrating, useless game. Every time you go to grab the watermelon, it would slip out of your hands and some dirty, wet guy would try to steal it away from you. My negative conclusions about the watermelon would be correct, but not complete. For I would be evaluating the watermelon with what I would call a limited criteria. So I use the case of the watermelon, for I would expect that most of you would never evaluate a watermelon based upon its use in a dirty lake with a bunch of guys. You'd more than likely commend it to me as something to be enjoyed by the taste buds. So, how does that lead into Ecclesiastes? Do I need to change something, Pastor, on it? Do I need to change something on the... That's fine, I can post it for the iPad just in case. Okay. All right, I will. I think I'm at a healthy one, but I'll be ready for it. Okay, thank you. All right, that's just in case the iPad goes dead. All right, I got it here. Okay, all right, thanks. So, just as that negative conclusion about the watermelon being impossible to hold and play a game with, so the author of this book states the reality of life being futile and fading because there is no possibility for gain in the order of creation. So that's how I mentioned that in the beginning. So the author then takes this conclusion, and now he's going to lead us on a quest as to the tendency of the accuracy of such thinking. Usually a quest starts with the hope of discovering something new or beneficial. Because if someone says, hey, I encourage you, you ought to come with me on this journey, and they usually entice with, like, you're going to find out something new, something you've never experienced before, and it's at least an incentive to go on it. This quest, however, is about exploring the despairing theme of the futility of life. So lest you think that the journey is going to be marked by many things that prove the opposite of life being futile, like, oh, he's really just going to, he's saying that, but life really isn't futile. Well, I tell you, don't get your hopes up. He will only enhance and be more descriptive about the futility. And that's important. You need to hear this theme that life sought in this way is futile. So lest you think that's what we're holding out for, he's going to be honest about that. In case you think that the quest is carried out in a poor manner, in other words, oh, he's just kind of, he makes a few casual observations, but is not very diligent in his search. Well, the author stresses at least four different times in these few verses that he's conducting the search with wisdom. That's how he says he's carrying it out. This isn't some fool who's recklessly going about doing whatever his heart wants to do and then comes up with a negative conclusion. That's not how the quest is carried out. So, if an introduction to a message is supposed to draw you in to listen, I would think I just gave you plenty of reason not to listen. However, I encourage you to go back to the text with this question. Should you abandon something just because it doesn't yield the expected results? Can a quest marked by failure end with a beneficial find? So the reason I pull that in with that illustration, just because we concluded a watermelon is useless for a dirty lake game, what's the point? You can't work. It doesn't work in the game. Doesn't mean that watermelon is useless. It's just that's not what you use it for. So if you're intrigued by the journey of, I don't know if I want to go on it, but there's something that's drawing me in, let's proceed on this. We only get a few feet into this journey with our teacher and our guide, and he turns around to us to give us the first, I'll call it, encouraging bit of information. And this is what he says. A wise quest does not always get satisfying answers. A wise quest does not always get satisfying answers. It's as if he looks at you following him on this quest, and he looks at all your gear, and he looks at your fitness, in a commending way, like, boy, you're ready, you got the gear, but then declares how ineffective that good gear and fitness could be. So he commends it, but then talks about its ineffectiveness. Well, let's see what he means by this. Starting there in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, it says, I, the preacher, here's our guide, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, here it is again, he starts repeating it, all is vanity and a striving after a wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So let me just show the little bit of the layout there is, he tells you about the quest and how this quest is going to work. And I would see, as he describes this quest, I would use the words, it's like he's leaving no rocks unturned or any path unexplored. The way he went about this quest, he was very diligent in what he did. At the same time, he does remind us that his search was limited to what? Here's this next phrase, that which is under heaven. Or as we saw in the introduction, that which is under the earth. So I was diligent in it, but let me tell you what the limits of my request too. And then we see that repeated theme of futility. I went after it and I couldn't grasp it. It was elusive and meaningless, as we saw in the introduction. And then there, he brings in something this time. There is this added frustration. You see that verse, this translation says, the burdensome task. That it almost seems like the added frustration of God himself making this search troubling or an unhappy business. God himself seems to have marked the quest for meaning as an unhappy business. Then we're introduced for the first time, and he's going to say it many times, that a vivid image of pursuing meaning, I'm trying to find what life is about, is likened to chasing the wind. And he's going to say this all throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. And then what he does there in verse 15, it's like a proverb to illustrate what he has said. And the proverb there is, God has set things up in a certain way, and wisdom, in all its quest to get it, can't change the way things are. Now, unless you say, so is wisdom not commended? Well, hold on, because we're going to have a lot of questions, but wisdom can't change it. He's like, something that is crooked, it can't be straightened. And just because he's finding in his quest, I want to figure things out. And he says, wisdom's not straightening it out. One does not avoid, you know, I'll try to illustrate, what do you mean by crooked things can't be straightened? If you live in this life, wise or not, you can't avoid destructive weather, disease, old age. All in your wisdom, you can't change those things. So in verses 12 through 15, he describes, here's how I carried out my quest. Well, in verses 16 through 18, he gives some general ways in which he pursued wisdom itself. And it's like he puts his personal name in there. He says, I communed with my heart in verse 16, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In terms of a guide, okay, we're just picturing, we're walking with him. I could see him making a list of practices that will surely get one hurt or lost, okay? When we're on a journey, don't do this. If you don't stay with the group, you're going to get lost, and it's going to change things dramatically. So that's what he does. And then he makes another list of essential things you must do for a successful journey. So it's like he goes, I compared folly, like here's the things that will surely get you lost and mess, and here's wisdom. And I'm going to weigh out both. And here's what he said about it. He did succeed in his effort of becoming wise. And you see that, it's like, more than any other one, I succeeded at becoming wise, unlike anyone else in Jerusalem before him. And then he says, I looked at both sides, wisdom and foolishness. And what he found was the search was not satisfying. Matters could not be grasped. And then that's when he adds this, finding out how things really are. If you want to study and figure things out, it's a sorrowful business. When you truly try to grasp and all that's going on in the world, and see, it's like that knowledge can lead to very much sorrow. There is a mental pain that goes in with getting wisdom. Now, I said this already, it's important to note that wisdom is not being put down as useless. We got to keep that in mind, because we may think, is he correct in this? The author is carrying out his endeavor with wisdom. He's later going to commend it. However, he's finding as he introduces, like, this is my quest, it's ultimately not bringing meaning and satisfaction. So as we hear his introduction right at the beginning of the journey, I'd almost picture him like, so do you want to continue? But as we go on to it, here's a phrase I'd like to put for you. You ever heard that phrase, that's for me to know and you to find out? Well, when you hear that, that's usually never a satisfactory answer. It's usually met with how come I can't know? And you think he's holding out something on me and doesn't want me to know. However, there are times when that limitation can be both frustrating and comforting. Well, how so? Well, the one in the know may be withholding something that he is eager to share and he knows it's just not the right time. So before we conclude, you're being so cruel and holding out. I'm like, no, his holding out may be a very good thing that he's trying to do. He's eager to share something, or he's actually holding something that he knows would not be beneficial to you. So having introduced us to the nature of his quest, like here's a quest to show, the introduction said, life is meaningless and purposeless. Well, let me go on a quest to really prove if that's true or not. And you heard there at the beginning, a wise quest he carried out with wisdom, had it, does not always yield satisfying answers. Well, now he's going to say, I'm going to put my heart to the test. Let me see if that's so. And he's going to take a couple things and say, here, let me test my heart to see if really gain is elusive. And here's the first one he tried it with is, can a heart find gain and satisfaction in pleasure? Because that's a natural thing. Well, if this was life, well, let me chase after something to try to find meaning. And here's where many go. They go to pleasure. Now you're going to see this contrast constantly. Pleasure fills. There is something enjoyable and satisfactory to it, but it flees. Have you ever experienced the following within the same minutes, sometimes even seconds? Ecstatically, you may hear, or you may have said it, you've heard it say, yes, we won the championship. And the deflating as the coach, everyone walks in the field, see you next season. Like, wait, that was the culmination. This was ecstatic, and then see you next season seems to take everything out of that ecstatic moment. Or ecstatically, that was the best vacation ever. And the deflating, call into work the next day. Like, oh. Within seconds of ecstatic, you're down, and it's all, it's just gone quickly. Well, I think that would introduce, as we come to Ecclesiastes 2, he's going to put pleasure to the test. Well, look at verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth or pleasure, enjoyment. Therefore, enjoy pleasure.
but surely this also was vanity. And notice what he's doing. He goes, I'm going to put my heart to the test. I'm going to see how my heart responds to the test of pleasure. So that's what he puts before it. And with this part, he's going to say, let me start exploring this area of pleasure. And the first one he says of this area of pleasure, he goes, laughter. He takes laughter, joking, frivolity, stuff like this. He says, I said of laughter, madness. And of mirth, what does it accomplish? Now, no compliment is given to laughter here. Because he just comes up, this is foolishness. That's what he thinks of laughter. Later in chapter 3, he's going to say, there is a time for laughter. So he doesn't commend it here, but think through laughter. It has limits. Ecclesiastes 7:3, and we'll come to this, but I'm going to touch it right now, is it speaks of sorrow as being the better teacher. It's like it has a place, but it has its limits. It cannot teach us how to live well. That's what he finds out about sorrow. I must just say laughter. And you think about many of the distortions of laughter. I think of Proverbs 14:13, how laughter, it talks about, is almost like the cover-up for sorrow. I laugh because I'm trying to be happy, but deep down I have a sorrow that's going on in my soul. And he speaks of that laughter that's ineffective to heal sorrow. It's a cover-up, but it's limited in helping in sorrow. It has limits in relationships. There is beauty in just sitting with best friends and laughing, but laughter can't build relationships. I think of a group that merely they hang out and they, hey, remember this movie, and they talk about this and they share all those things. But if that relationship is ever to move on to something real and to be built, it's going to have to be something beside laughter. Laughter can't build relationships. Think of the Proverbs 25:20, where it speaks of the aggravating effect of he who comes in with the joyful song in the morning. What does it do to a heart in the morning? It's just like, it's repulsive to it. Laughter has its limits. And many times laughter is perverted, right? Because people who want to ignore life, they sin and live up they want, and it's like the fool's laughter that just jokes as though it ignores reality. So what we find about is, he doesn't commend it here, laughter, if I look to the pleasure of laughter, it's empty. It doesn't accomplish something. Well, he goes on to the next thing. Well, let me test my heart with something else. And he says there in verse 3, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. Now, things noted about this test was his endeavor to see the pull or enjoyment of wine. What would it have on his body? It's interesting that he notes he carried out this experiment, he's going to repeat a couple times, with wisdom. He was seeking to be discerning on this, not just give his heart totally up to it. He is seeking what is best for a man to do in his short life under the sun. He will speak later in the book regarding the enjoyment factor of this. And we know, though, of other wisdom literature that speaks of the great negative effect of it. I want to see, put my heart to the test. How will wine, what will it do to my body? And he's trying to test it. He doesn't give any conclusions here. He's just saying, here's something else I put my heart in my body to the test with. Well, he creates yet another pleasurable test for his heart with grand works for himself. So look at verses 4 through 6. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Now, what do you note about, he's testing his heart with this pleasure, grand and great things he created. So you note the creativity. But do you notice something that, what was the point of his creativity? I made it for myself. Worth is being sought in what can my hands make? Now there is much beauty and good that is done through what man creates. I mean, we live in all kind of incredible creations that man make with their words, with their hands, and technology. So there's much beauty to it. But men easily look to the work of their hands, what they can create, as their salvation. One man was noted for saying this, of how he looked to the work of his hands in poetry. He was a great creative poet. And he says, after one has abandoned a belief in God, poetry is the essence which takes its place as life's redemption. I won't even go into how that man's life ended, but you hear like, okay, put away this concept of God, get freed from that, and find meaning in what you can create. And for him, it was poetry. Man's heart wants to find meaning in things he can create. Do you notice something about this? Test brings to light almost the paradise conditions that man tries to build. It's almost like you almost hear a little bit of Eden. Let me create massive works and great things that I can enjoy. That sounds almost like the garden trying to recreate. It's not bad, but we're not in Eden anymore. And I can't live that way. These grand efforts, I'll borrow someone else's picture when he says it, it's like building massive sandcastles by the sea. And you're impressed by the massiveness and look how elegant they are. But it's right next to the sea that will quickly wash it away. It is foolish to think that such things are permanent. It's not calling the creative work evil or bad, but to think that they provide lasting permanence is foolishness. Grand works like many of these quests are but diversions to keep us from thinking about our frailty. And that's where the author is trying to bring us, the guide. He needs us to feel our frailty, but many times these grand works, I hear it in the words like Nebuchadnezzar, look at these great things that I have built. Did not my hands do it? And that's where many run so many times for trying to find fulfillment. So he concludes his test with pleasure by a massive accumulation. In other words, he's still putting his heart to the test with a pleasure. Let me see how my heart responds. Here's his last one as far as a pleasure. He says, I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasure of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. You almost hear, don't you hear the New Testament thing? The one who's amassing these things in bigger barns. And they look to it for security. Having viewed this part of the quest could almost be like sitting at a retirement setting for a successful individual. He has his biography about his struggle and triumph. Here's his newly published book. He has part of the company or city named after him. And as you're sitting there as maybe a young guy, like, wow, look what that guy did and how he triumphed and how he succeeded. And you're inspired by his endeavor to make the best out of life. You're ready to go and get your copy of the book signed by him. Like, here's a great guy. I want to do what he did. However, before you get the book signed, listen to the teacher, the guide's conclusion about this pursuit of enjoyment and pleasure. He's led you on some things like, this is what I went after. This is what I sought. Now hear his conclusion before you want to say, get the book signing. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. He keeps repeating that theme. Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity. And grasping for the wind, there was no profit under the sun. At first, as you hear that conclusion, we don't hear anything amiss. We are reminded again the teacher and guy was endeavoring to be very discerning in his investigation. We didn't hear like this was some fool just running after things. At face value, the endeavor seems to be carried out to its fullest. Like, man, that guy really lived. I mean, he didn't just sit back and be lazy. He made something out of his life. But upon a closer look, do you hear that in the text, we hear him speak of things in terms of limits. His pursuit was carried out within the limits of what? His own desires. Whatever I desired, I didn't keep from it. So he's exploring it, everything that he can see. You even know in that the limitations. There was enjoyment in his search. He didn't say, oh, it was just a horrible thing. I didn't enjoy any of it. You hear enjoyment in it. However, as one author notes about this reality, and this is how he put it, to see our work with our eyes is the reward we gain or get. You hear that. He says, and this was the reward, to see my works. A man works all of his life with a company. He retires, receives a pen and the pat on the back. That moment of seeing the work is the best that that work can offer. Picturing a lady, she makes jewelry and scarves and markets them. She gets to see someone wear what she has made, rewarding. That moment of seeing is a wonderful gift, but the only advantage that her labor can offer her. That is the only thing it can give her. For this reason, affirmation and fame feel wonderful. I mean, you can almost, I picture sitting at that retirement like, this is great. It feels good. But each is, like he says, like a gypsy, a wanderer who fidgets to leave as soon as it arrives. Like it's there. Boy, this was great. And it's like the picture of a gypsy, as soon as it's there, it's gone. That's all it could give you. The somewhat haunting refrain is then repeated. Everything's meaningless, elusive. You can't get ahead. There is no advancement. So we see, he said, a wise quest doesn't always get satisfying answers. Pleasure does feel, in other words, it is satisfying, but it flees. Having given us this introduction about limited understanding and the perplexing enigma of empty success, how would you rate your teacher and guide at this point? If he said in modern terms, pull out your phones and please give me a thumbs up or down about your experience thus far. I think you may be like this is not a good quest. While you're thinking on it, like, I get what he's saying. Yeah, I don't want to write him off because he's pretty diligent in this. Our guide and teacher says, well, let me speak of another quest. I'm going to put my heart to the test with something else. I'm going to test it with wisdom. And here's how he would say it. Wisdom does not make masters. Wisdom does not make masters. Well, look there in verse 12 as he talks about his quest with wisdom. I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. I'm going to put both on the table here. For what can that man do who succeeds the king? And one little brief thought there is just like, the king has sought this. Who can outdo the king in this quest? It's like it can't be outdone what the quest he did with wisdom. Only what he has done or has already been done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So before he goes on to that, as you hear him saying this, here's a picture I would give you. If I spoke to you of two contestants in a rope climbing contest, one strengthened his muscles through exercise, got a personal trainer, and practiced each day to improve his skill. The other thought, I know everything about rope climbing. I know it all. And he didn't practice or anything before the event. He didn't prepare. Well, on the day of the contest, and if you picture my think of a rope climbing is up, I remember one we put it in a tall tree as an event, and you climb it and try to ring the bell at the top. So that's a picture I think of a rope climbing thing. On the day of the contest, the second individual, the lazy one, furiously started hoisting himself up the rope, but his grip gave away within 10 seconds in the climb. He just wasn't ready for it. The wise one, the first one, he walks up to the rope, seems a little more experienced and ready. He takes a deep breath, skillfully works his way up the rope, rings the bell on the top, but then falls to the bottom with rope burns all over his arms and legs. Which one was wiser? It almost seems like the fool who didn't go up the rope was the wiser. And that's how I would see as he talks about wisdom. The teacher speaks of his credentials with wisdom. It's insurpassable. In the words of Proverbs, you hear him, he commends wisdom over folly. Wow, why? Well, the fool stumbles around in the darkness. He says, like, he doesn't even know about what he stumbles. The wise knows how to navigate through life. However, something looms on the horizon for both the wise and the foolish that both of them can't avoid. Well, look at verse 14 and 15. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked? And I got my verses wrong there. So, because I did chapter 1. So you're going to have to read it. Because I usually put the verses in the text here. And I don't have my Bible with me. All right? So you're going to have to read the conclusion of that. I can do that. Sorry about that. There's a difference between chapter 1 and chapter 2. All right, so 14 and 15. Verse 15, then I said in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For there is no remembrance of the wise, more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? He dies as the fool. Before I read verse 17, you look at this. It's like, the wise face death just like the foolish. He'll be forgotten just like the fool. So the two main thoughts about the advantage and response of wisdom and the limits of wisdom. Before he goes on to the next quest, let me make some comments on this. And I do need to use, I think someone pictured it well. Because we're thinking about what is the advantage of wisdom. He acknowledges that. And then we're going to look at the limits of wisdom. The nature of why is important to be wise. We're going to look at the limits, but why is wisdom important? And he says there in verse 17, he goes, with this, he goes, I hated life. He admits that. But the response, this kind of hate to promote, differs substantially from the other two. I will oppose the life I hate with wisdom, he seems to say. Not because I will win in this world. I will likely not. And if you could put up with the human eye, I need to back up on something because that quote won't make sense here for a minute. So let me paint the picture. Here's the heading. I'm sorry, but that is, what is the advantage to just being wise? It looks like there's no importance to it. So here's how this would work, the setting. So if you picture a coach with a team, and let's just put them like a bunch of 7th and 8th graders. And he trains them, guys, this is how we do it. This is how we play. We play right. He teaches them skill how to do that.
and they come up against an opponent who's always being tricky. They don't play according to the rules, and they're going to try to be mean to you on the court, and you step onto that court with the refs who are in favor of the other team. Now, when you step on the court with that kind of team, and you see the dirty things that happen, and you see that they're going to get away with it with these refs, what is it easy to do? Just leave. But if you leave, what do you leave on the court? You leave folly on the court. Well, what if you stay on the court and play in with the fools? Well, they hit me, I'm going to hit them back. Guess what still remains on the court? Folly. So in this world, to commend wisdom, because he does commend it, this is where this conclusion will happen. Like, I hate life that has these limits. He's seeing that. That is a good thing, to hate this life that doesn't seem, with all its wisdom, to be successful. So now I think this will help. He admits, the response this kind of hate promotes differs substantially from the other two. I will oppose the life I hate with wisdom. I'm against foolishness, and I'm going to oppose it by living wisely. Not because I will win in this world. I likely will not. But at least wisdom will remain on the court. At least folly will no longer offer the only game in town. At least those who watch the game will have an alternative set in front of them. And those who play and get hurt will have a way of healing still available to them. In essence, the preacher changes the purpose for playing the game. He calls us to question the motive by which we seek God and the world. For the preacher, we don't play to win or to advance or to gain for ourselves. We play because of God and because of what such a relationship with God establishes. So I put that in there, and he's going to explore this more later. Wisdom, there is gain to it. He's talking of its limits, but wisdom needs to stay on the court. But let's explore just what we mean by the limits of this wisdom. And this goes into that heading, life is not meant to be mastered by wisdom. Realizing this can help you, and this is quoting another person, deal with life in a way that honors God. For example, don't be surprised to find yourself in a frustrating situation from which you cannot escape by means of controlling it. Not everything can be fixed. Not everything is a problem to be solved. Some things must be borne, must be suffered and endured. Wisdom does not teach us how to master the world. It does not give us techniques for programming life such that life becomes out orderly and predictable. And that's what it's so easy to do with wisdom. Okay, I'm going to do exactly how God says, and so life will line up and do exactly like I want. No, that's not why wisdom is to be pursued. I think that's what you hear here is wisdom is not meant to make us masters of our fate. It shows us how to relate to God and live in the world, but it has its limits. So it seems very noble, does it not? Like, I pursued wisdom, good thing, but I still find this meaninglessness to it. So our teacher and guide has one more noble quest that he wants to bring to our attention. It reminds me of a science bug project from the seventh grade, which I had, I gathered the bugs. It was an insect project. I gathered the bugs, had them all laid out in a display for the next day of school. You had to label them. This is this bug. You had to pin it to the felt board. Well, when I woke, I found that another creature had found my project that night and had eaten some of the bugs from my project. And here's this, I lead this into his last quest of, well, let me go at hard work. Let me see. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to toil for this game. I'm going to put work to the test. Does it provide meaning? And here's his conclusion about, for look at the verse, hard work does not yield permanent results.
I still remember, it's just like, you put all into it and you're ready for presentation and like, boom, there was the pile of the work I put into it. Well, look at his quest with this one. I think I have the right verses here on this one. And he kind of pulls up that thing of, then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun. You'll hear this over and over again, toiling, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Then I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor, and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful, and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. So when you look at that, what you hear is, I toiled for this, but it's elusive. There's nothing permanent. The thing I labor for, I give it to someone else, and it may be a fool who just totally ignores all the work I put into something I put my life into. And so again, he takes another thing, says, hard work. Let me see if it'll provide meaning. Surely it will. And you hear the same conclusion. So, at this point, we may be ready to give our teacher, a guide, a permanent thumbs down on the presentation. This was an awful quest. I don't know why. That journey with you was a waste. Or did the futility of seeking gain from the things in this life actually teach us what life was all about? Unless we have this teacher as our guide, we may come to some accurate conclusions, but we're going to have a horrible response. And let me give an example of some things. Some may look at the futility of life and say, away with God. There is no reason worth living. And it's just they look at these kind of quests that we just went through and said, see, there is no God. There is no purpose. And he makes that conclusion and responds by rejecting God. Others may say, yep, that's how life is, just fleeting, vain. So live it up. Go for the pleasure. Get all you can. That's how some may conclude. There may even be a sound like a godly response of, well, you know, life is like this, but you can find meaning just, you got to pray a lot and do godly things to make up for it. In other words, it's almost like a pietist response of, this is how you erase the vanity by doing all these positive things. Again, to be commended, but is that the instruction we need to hear? We need to hear what the teacher says of, here's my conclusion on that. In light of the opening illustrations, just because the watermelon is not to be commended for a dirty late game, like there's no point in that watermelon. It's like, what's the point? That thing's useless. You can't grab it. Every time you try it, it gets away from you. Does not mean that it's not to be enjoyed. You would say, you ever thought about cutting the watermelon and eating it? Well, do you hear this in the final verses of Ecclesiastes 2? Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him his good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So I'll use the quote of a man as he puts it this way. What is his advice? The gift of God does not make this meaningless life go away. This is accurate. We were supposed to feel that. The gift of God makes this vanity enjoyable. In other words, what he's saying is, the gifts that you're trying to pursue meaning in, you won't find happiness in them. What it is, it's like the gifts that God gave are meant to be enjoyed from him. So if you know things are on the horizon that could be terrible things and plagues, do I just sit there and freeze and say, oh, life is terrible and bad? It's like the gifts that God gave to enjoy, enjoy them. And hopefully you follow the quest. We usually say, oh, okay, whew, this is good things at the end. I'll just enjoy life. No, not to be pursued. You're going to face toil. You're going to face meaningless. You're going to face hard things. Take the very gifts of God and enjoy them in the day. Now, there's so much more we're going to go on to. We're going to follow him through the book. But that's how he concludes. In fact, he's going to build on this. He's going to say this like five different times in the book. It's not he's saying, so just go live life like you want. God is the one who gives enjoyment. Enjoy it as from him rather than making a pursuit out of it for your gain. So there's a lot I want to add to that, but I'm going to let the book kind of build on that. That's how the teacher, our guide, concludes the quest. It's very futile. It's meaningless. I tried things. I tried wisdom. I tried pleasures. I tried working hard. I tried to make great things and creative things. And he helps by saying, that's elusive. You can't gain from it. God gives us these things to enjoy, not to pursue as something in advancement for our name. Let's pray. Our God, we bow to you tonight. We need your help. Because it's almost like, okay, yeah, let's just put those hard realities aside. And the death is coming and these things are futile. And let's just focus on the day and enjoy the day, the pleasures of today. So would you keep in mind, our mind, that the futility of these things, and then help us to enjoy you, to use your gifts rightly, to give to others, to love others with them, not consume them upon ourselves. God, we look to you, to Christ, who alone can help us on this. Lord, we need your help. And we ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. All right. Thanks for tuning in tonight, and we will see you Wednesday night or next Sunday.